Visit our website at BostonBastardBrigade.com for recent news, reviews, podcast episodes, and videos featuring members of the B3 crew.
Become friends with us on MySpace at MySpace.com/BostonBastardBrigade, as well as on Facebook. You can even find our Twitter accounts on our official homepage.
And don't forget to check out our friends at the Electric Sisterhood at ESH.MOBI for another side of news and review, including their own glorious podcast show.
Hi, this is King Baby Duck, and this past weekend I was over at Anime Boston 2010 at the Heinz Convention Center. During my stay there, I happened to have the chance to interview four people. They were Maimu from Gaggling, J. Michael Tatum, the voice actor, Dick Tripwire, the mastermind of the Hentai Dummings, and the Final Fantasy composer Nobuo Uematsu. Now, what you're about to hear is a bonus podcast episode with three of the four people I interviewed. Now, the Uematsu interview, unfortunately, is going to have to be written out because it was part of like a little press conference sort of thing, because there was a few other people that were interviewing him as well. So look out for that little interview in maybe within a few days or so. But right now, we are going to be listening to the interviews with Maimu, J. Michael Tatum, and Dick Tripwire. So sit back and relax and enjoy this bonus podcast show. Take it away, maid guy. From the Heinz Convention Center, this is the Boston Bastard Brigade Special Report from Anime Boston 2010. Sing here with me now is the lead singer and songwriter for the band Gaggling. She has published a memoir about her early years with the band called Suyoi Namida, and on occasion works as a fashion model. It's my pleasure welcoming to B3 the lovely and talented Maimu. Maimu, yokoso Boston Bastard Brigade.
Hi, yokoso. Konnichiwa.
Now, first off, you didn't really get into the music scene until you went and saw the Rolling Stones in concert. What was it about Mick Jagger and company that made you realize that you wanted to be part of the music industry?
音楽をやる前に私はやっぱ鬱っていうものを掲げてずっと抱いてて、初めてその久しぶりに外の世界に出た時に行ったのがそのローリングストーンズのライブで、そのローリングストーンズのなんだろうな、あのそれまでこうやってずっと沈んでた気持ちが初めてそのライブを見たことによって、あこの曲も知ってる、あこの曲も知ってるって心が踊った瞬間を見れたのは、別に食べることでもない、ファッションをおしゃれすることでもない、音楽で初めてその心が動いたっていうところで、やっぱり音楽の力ってすごいんだなって、それがたまたまローリングストーンズだったからなのかはわからないけども、でもやっぱりローリングストーンズのあのドーム、東京ドームでのあのものすごいパフォーマンスに私はやっぱりすごいインスピレーションを感じて、はい。
When she was younger, she was actually she had a lot of depression and didn't really leave the house very much. And one of the first things that she did when she finally was able to sort of rejoin society was she went to a Rolling Stones concert. So, and that sort of experience was just amazing for her. Like, she was really able to, when she listened to the music, she realized that she recognized a lot of the songs that she'd listened to when she was at home. So that, coupled with the experience of just being in the dome, like with this amazing band and sort of being surrounded by the music, sort of really opened the door. And through the music, she was sort of able to really come out of her shell and sort of rejoin society. So that's why the Rolling Stones were so important for her.
It's really nice. It's really cool. I like that. Now, besides the Rolling Stones, who else has inspired you musically?
Linkin Park と、Aerosmith と、Avril Lavigne、Evanescence.
Okay, so Linkin Park, Aerosmith, Evanescence, and Avril Lavigne.
Ooh, good blend of music right there.
Yeah.
Now, when did you first meet Moto and Cherry, and when did you figure out that there was like good enough chemistry for the three of you to form a band?
私がそうバンドをやろうと思って、まず最初にメンバー探しに行って、ライブハウスをこうやっていくつか回った時に、最初にそのモッちゃんに出会って、彼の弾いたギターで私は歌いたいって思って声をかけたんです。そしたらその彼は今時そうやってなんか出待ちとかしてそうやって一緒にバンドやりましょうっていう人が少ない時代だったのでその行動力になんていうんですかあすごいこの子面白いと思ってくれてでちょうど私がそのもっちゃんに連絡した時と同時期に彼がスタジオで今のそのチェリーさんと仕事をしてた時にバンドを作ろうって話が出てたところに私がそうやって現れたんですよでそれでじゃあ僕とチェリーさんでバンドを作ろうと思ってたんだけど歌ってみるって言われてじゃあやりましょうっていうことになりました
When I decided to start doing the band I started by going to live housesand checking out the different music. And there was where I met with Moto, or Mo-chan, she calls him. And when she heard him playing the guitar, she thought, oh, I really want to sing for this guy's guitar playing. So she sort of approached him and told him that I was interested in starting a band. And actually, at the time, there weren't really a lot of people who were starting bands, so it just so happened that he was kind of interested in that, so really it was just sort of fate, almost, that his interests and my interests sort of combined. And when I got in contact with him, he happened to be, at the time, with Cherry at doing like work with him, so when I called him and told him that I wanted to start a band, he sort of mentioned it to Cherry, andHe also decided that he really wanted to do that. So everything just sort of came together. It was like fate.
Yeah, so it just practically worked out for you.
Yeah.
Terrific. Now, what is the meaning behind the name Gagalang?
ドラムのチェリーさんのバンドがリンドバーグ、元リンドバーグ、ドラムのチェリーさんがこのガガーリングをやる前にやってたバンドがリンドバーグって言って、そのチャールズ・リンドバーグから取った名前。だけど、僕たちっていうか私たちは世界規模で、もっと宇宙規模で、なんだろう、勇気と探求心とかを掲げて頑張っていこうっていうので、初の宇宙飛行士のユーリ・ガガーリンの何日なんで、わかります?
え?
初の宇宙飛行士、ユーリ・ガガーリン。地球は青かったって言った、
それって、
歴史上の
人物で。日本人
じゃない、ロシア人。ロシア人の初めて宇宙月面着陸した人。で、チャールズ・リンドバーグは大西洋横断ですよね。大西洋横断で、それよりももっと大きい規模で私たちも頑張っていこうっていうで、宇宙規模で考えて頑張っていこうっていうことで、ユーリ・ガガーリンの名前にちなんで、最後に ING、いつも現在進行形で言おうって言って、ガガーリングっていう名前になりますと。
So, the, Tiddy said,So the drummer, Cherry, who was originally a member of the band called Lindbergh, their name came from Charles Lindbergh, you know, the name of the ship that crossed the ocean. But what they were thinking was they wanted something more global, so even bigger than just crossing an ocean. They wanted to cross the world. Right. So they took the name from Yuri Gagarin, who I believe was Gagarin. So this person was one of the first to go into space.So they took the name from the person who's, out into space, and then they added the ING to sort of show that it's a sort of constant process. So they're constantly going out into the world. Sort of.
Nice. So it's kind of like it's your big goal to for your music to spread all across the planet. Awesome. Now, so far you've released three albums. You have the 2005 album Royal Punks, the 2006 album Royal Blood, and the 2008 album Royal Stranger. Now, what is the reason behind the usage of the word royal in the albums?
私たちはそこで自分たちのオリジナリティを見出し、いつもその自分たちの織りなす音楽にプライドを持って気高く行こうっていう意味でロイヤルっていう、はい。常に自分たちは自由なことをしつつも私たちの誇りであるっていう意味で、とても特別なものなんだよっていう意味で、そのロイヤルの、たまには、 パンクス、なんか、ちょっとキツ魂やるのか、ブラッド、それは血なのか、ストレンジャーちょっと異端児みたいな、なんか、だけど、常に誇りを持っているっていう意味で、はい。So,
I guess, really, the big reason why we use the word royal is to show how much pride we have in our work. So, I mean, as you know, we are a rock group, and depending on who you talk to, you know, rock is maybe not really considered a very sort of socially acceptable sort of type of genre. You know, it's sort of maybe looked down upon. But, you know, as a group, we really want to show how much pride we have in our work. So that's why we use the word royal to really show that. And then, of course, you know, we are rock bands, so we'd use words like, you know, like punks, or then, you know, like the blood that's running, you know, that's the blood that sort of connects us all. And then it's just... But really, it's just to show that the music is really special and really important, and we have a lot of pride in it, so that's why we use the word royal.
So what's the story behind the title for Royal Stranger? Is it more like those, like a special person that you haven't come to meet yet, or is it something else?
ビジュアル系の方に一気に行ったんですよ。その時はやっぱり女子っていうのがNGでしょ。でもそこに行った、異端児、異端児ってわかります？なんていうのかな。ちょっと奇妙な人、奇妙な。だから、そう、だから、私たちは、その、ちょっと入っていけない世界に行った、
Well, like I said, the royal was really showing where the pride came from, but the stranger's part of it was the fact that as a group with a female lead singer, which in the visual K world is now maybe not so much, but at the beginning when we started was very, very, very unusual. Mm-hmm. So I guess in terms of us being royal strangers into the world of visual K, the royal part was us showing our pride, and then the strangest was the fact that we were sort of pioneering and entering for the first time into this world.
Oh. So it's like you were trying to break the mold.
Exactly.
Instead of being like, say, like an idol, you went a totally different route that most women in the Japanese music industry wouldn't do.
So, like, 普通になんか女性が入らない世界なのに、こうなんか一気で、なんか頑張って入ろうとして、とてもいい。
That's a message, and it's definitely something that I'd like. I love seeing more women do that in the music industry.
You're welcome.
Now, back to your love for the Rolling Stones. You covered their hit song "Ruby Tuesday" on your album "Royal Punks." What made you decide to do this song out of the hundreds that they've recorded?
これは、そのローリングストーンズのライブ見に行った時に、やっぱ歌ってて、で、そのメンバーを探す時にデモテープ作るでしょ。そのデモテープを、そのルビーチューズで、ローリングストーンズに影響されたので、ローリングストーンズの中から一曲デモテープを作ろうって思ったんですよ。で、たまたま入ったカフェの BGM で、 メラニーっていう女性ボーカルがルビーチューズデをもっとアレンジを変えて歌ってたのを聞いて、これだと思って私も 彼らのオリジナル曲をちょっとアレンジ自分でしてデモテープを作ってそれを持って元あのに声をかけたところから始まってるんです。でそしたらそれを聞いた元とチェリーさんがチェリーが音を作るからそれにちゃんとした歌を載せないかって言ってくれてでそれをプロデューサーに持ってったっていう流れなんです。
Actually the song when I was going around looking for members I brought a demo disc to you know to show to the people who would be prospective band members and when I was still deciding what song to do I just one day just happened to go into a cafe where they were playing the song Ruby Tuesday, which was being covered by a singer named Melanie. So she had sort of rearranged the song and made a cover of it. And when I walked into the cafe and heard the song, I thought, oh, that's the song I want to do. So I sort of made my own version of it, made it into a demo, and then that's the demo that I brought around when I was looking for my band members. So when Cherry heard it, he offered to, you know, properly rearrange the song and then bring it to the producers. So that's how that came about.
It's a great cover, by the way. It's a different rearrangement, rearrangement from it, but it's still a pretty good cover, because a lot of times, like, when you hear someone try to cover another song, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's terrible. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, you did a very, very good job with keeping with the spirit of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
マイムさんが作ったカバーがすごくいいって。
あ、嬉しい。
で、なんかそのニックジャガーの、そのスピリットがすごく感じます。マイムさんが作ったカバーのバージョンが。なんかすごく、すごくいい。
嬉しい。
Thank you, she's really happy.
You got the name.
Thanks.
Now, what happens to be some of your personal favorite tracks that you've written for Gagaling? And why do you feel that they stand out more than others?
ピアスですね、うん、ピアスはまだ本当にラフに作った時点でラフで曲を作り上げていく途中で私聴いてたら普通に自然に涙が出た曲だったんですよ。で自分の声が乗っかって完成してた時にあの涙何だったんだろうと思ったら視聴ランキングでマイスペースの視聴ランキングで1位取った曲が唯一その曲で、その聴いてくれた視聴してくれた人が私が感じたあの時の涙と同じものを感じてくれたのかなって思ったんですね。で、あ、この曲には曲のパワー、音楽のパワーがこの曲には宿ってるんだろうなって思ったのがそのピアスだったんです。
So I guess if I had to choose one, definitely my favorite song would be Pierce.And when I was making it, you know, when it was still in the process of making it, and I was hearing the song, just all of a sudden I started crying. And once the song was finished, and I was listening to, you know, I guess I couldn't quite think about what it was that made me cry at that time, but then, I checked and actually on MySpace, the song Pierce became number one. So when I thought about it, I realized that it's, you know,in order for it to become number one, it's like people who were hearing the song were also feeling whatever it was that made me cry at that time. And when I thought about it, I realized that I think it was really the power of music. Mm. And I really feel that in that song, the power of music is the song that I've made that really shows that the most. So,
wow.
That's my favorite song.
Yeah, it's definitely one of your strongest songs out of everything you've written so far. One of my favorites that you've done is Little Giant on My Shoulder.And not just because of your strong vocals, but there's a part, I think it's the guitar solo, where Moto just seems like he's channeling Brian May from Queen and does like a guitar solo that only Brian May was able to do, but Moto has perfected it just wonderfully.
Yeah, この方の、すごく好きな曲は Little Giant on My Shoulder っていう曲で、
それを作った時はみんな、もうメンバーも一番その曲が好きでした。
So it seems like when they made that song also, that all the members really liked that song. ねえ、なんかそのギターソロの部分が、フジさんがなんかすごくクイーンみたいな、
そう、
すごい音が出て、なんかこのなんかすごく好きです、その曲。
もっちゃんのギターは本当に歌ってるような感じに。
So you're saying, もっちゃんの guitar like sings.
It does remind me a little bit of the Bohemian Rhapsody type of sound that you would hear.
She'll let him know.
Now, besides your work in the music industry, you also spent some time in the fashion world as a model. Now, do you have like a specific type of clothing you like to model? And in what way do you feel that music and fashion coincide with one another?
好きなファッションというかファッションブランドはもうやっぱり H&M が好きで、ずっと PV でもずっと H&M を使ってきて、でもちろん H&M のモデルもやったことあるし、H&M のファッションショーにも出たこともあるぐらい H&M は大好きなんですけど、その音楽とファッションっていうのは絶対切っても切れない縁だと思ってるんですよ。だから私はやっぱりなんかそのブランドに、音楽のなんだプラスアルファがそのファッションだって自分では思ってて、だからこの曲にはこういうイメージの H&M を着るとかで、たまにはその本当にデザイナーさんと自分でこういうものを表現したいっていうのを作ってもらう、これもオーダーメイドなんですけど、でだからなんかいくらでも想像が膨らませて、いくらでもこうやってなんか合体させられるものだなと思いますね。
Okay, so I guess the fashion that she's really into is the stuff by H&M, and you know, always usesH&M music clothes in the music videos. I've also appeared in like fashion shows for H&M clothing, and really I believe that music and fashion are inseparable. And for example, like the clothes I'm wearing right now, this is actually custom made by H&M. So it turns out that what he's trying to express through his clothes and what I'm trying to express through my music are the same. So it was really just a bond that was meant to be. So we really just see eye to eye in a lot of in what we're trying to express, and I think it shows.
Kind of like what David Bowie does and Lady Gaga, and a lot of musicians out there do stuff like this to not just get the brand out, but because they feel like what they wear helps represent what the music is all about.
Yeah,
she agrees.
What inspired you to write your memoir, Suyoi Namida? And what did you discover about yourself while you were writing about the past?
First, 強い涙を書こうと思った本当に一番の理由は、やっぱり自分自身が鬱で悩んでる子がたくさんいる。もうこんなにもいるのっていうぐらいやっぱたくさんいて、あとやっぱり日本は自殺大国になってしまったので、やっぱそういう人たち、苦しんでる人たちに向けて、一人じゃないんだよって、みんな同じ苦しみを持ってるし、でも何かのきっかけで、私はそれがたまたま音楽だったけども、必ず開ける道はあるんだよっていうことをやっぱ書けたらすごくいいなと思っていて、プラス何が分かったかっていうと、やっぱり私自身の存在っていうものがここにあるんだっていうことがすごく分かりましたね。はい。
So, you know, like I said earlier, when I was younger, I was just really, really depressed. And when I decided to write, the reason I decided to write this was because when, really, I feel like music saved me. And I realized that I was not alone. You know, Japan has a really high rate of people who commit suicide. So it's a really big problem. And I was lucky enough to sort of get to meet music, and that's what saved me. So I wanted to write a book to tell people that they're not alone, and to tell them that, you know, something out there will save you. You know, just like it saved me. So I just really wanted to share that feeling with other people, because I know that there are a lot of other people who used to feel the same way I did.
Not just in Japan, but the rest of the world can truly learn from your experiences and just basically show how you managed to get out of it and how you managed to get better for yourself. Now, do you have any plans to publish this memoir outside of Japan?
したいですね。もうそれはしたいですけど、今は日本だけですね。
Well, you know, I'd really like it to. You know, it would be really great if it could. For now, it's just in Japan, but maybe someday.
I hope so too, because it does sound like it's something that a lot of people can really enjoy and just really learn from. Now, this is your second time you've been to America, your first being at Anime Expo 2007. What fascinates you about the American culture, and does anything about America inspire you as an artist?
みんな参加してくれる、あの、で、すごくとても楽しいし、あの、一生懸命イベントに参加する。みんながなんか、あの、なんていうのかな、真剣に真面目にそう参加するところが軽く考えてないというか、もう本当に楽しむことを思い切り楽しんで、っていう国柄なのかなってすごく思いました。やっぱり日本人ちょっとシャイな部分があるので、そこがすごく大きな違いだなって思ったのと、あと全てが大きい。
I think what I really, really like about American culture is just the way that the American people just really kind of pour their hearts into what they do. And they're really, like, they're really open, they're really free, and they really just...They don't overthink things. If they're going to enjoy themselves, they really, really enjoy themselves. I think like Japanese people maybe kind of hold back a little bit or they're a little bit shy, so they maybe don't kind of let themselves go the way that Americans do. So I really, you know, impressed with that sort of ability that Americans could just sort of let themselves go. And also just how everything is so big here.
Yeah. You're not the only one who I've talked to that said that they like how...Everything in America is bigger. I remember hearing from Sally Yamanaka from The Pillows talking about how he was just shocked about how everything was just so big in America compared to in Japan.
No, Mayu さんだけじゃない。そういうなんかアメリカの全部が大きいとか好き、そういうのが好きっていう人は、あの、前、あの、Sai Yamazaki さん、あの、Pillows の Sai Yamazaki と、あの、一緒に話した時も、その方も、あの、全部大きいって言って、すごく、多分みんなそういうことになります
ね。Now, why did you decide to go solo for this trip to America instead of bringing Moto and Terry with you?
本当は、なんで、連れてきたかったんですけど。
So, actually, originally the whole band was supposed to come, but really there was just a lot going on and the other band members couldn't come. But I really, really, really wanted to come.To the United States, so I decided to just take this chance and come. So.
And I hope it's a really good chance that you made. Now, what do you feel the differences are between like Japanese audiences compared to American audiences? Do you feel there's a difference between performing in the two countries?
全然違う。やっぱりそれここもやっぱり、あの、日本だと。あのわーって手を挙げるのも恥ずかしいから心の中で楽しんだりとかいろんな楽しみ方をするんですよ。私は小さく楽しむわ、私は大きく楽しむわ。でもアメリカだともう、みんなダーンで最初から最後までみたいな。だからそこがやっぱりこっちもなんかどんどんどんどんボルテージが上がってしまうというか。
Yeah, so like I said before, you know, just performing in Japan where, you know, the people areThey really kind of hold back, even if they're enjoying themselves. It's like they're enjoying themselves like inside, and they don't really let it out. But coming here, you know, just from the beginning to the end, everyone is just like, you know, full power, like full yelling. Just everything is really, really powerful and energetic. And, you know, that really gives me a lot of energy, too. So I really enjoy performing here.
Next time you perform in Japan, try to get like a little mosh pit going. Help them get that energy out of them.
じゃあぜひあのまた今度日本ねあのその何かショーとかするときはぜひ日本人にも出せるように頑張ってください。
Now you're going to be performing acoustically at the show on Sunday. How do you feel about performing something like that? Are you a little bit nervous about?Performing without the other band members, or do you feel okay with it?
未知の世界。でも、なんか、やるならやっぱせっかくだから、思い切りやりたいし、あの、楽しみです。自分でも。
Well, you know, yeah, I will be alone, but, I'm gonna do my best. Like, I know the band isn't there with me, but, you know, I'm here, I really wanna take advantage of it, and I wanna, you know, really.
And I know the other band members are there with you in spirit.
Yeah. 多分いますよ一緒に心の中に、はい、
ぜひ。
Now, what's next for Gaga Ling? Are there any plans to tour or make another album in the near future?
またメンバーみんなでアメリカに行きたいです。
I would really like to come back to the United States with all the members. So that would be something we'll be looking forward to.
I look forward to that as well. The final question, what would you like to say to your American fan base?
ぜひガガーリングに会いに日本へ来てください。
I hope you guys come to Japan to meet Gaga Ling someday.
Maimu, arigato gozaimasu.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on the Boston Mastery.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Very much the Mastery. My guest today is a voice actor, writer, and ADR director for Funimation, best known for his roles in such series as Spice and Wolf, Ouran High School Host Club, Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, and School Rumble. Please welcome Mr. J. Michael Tatum.
Wow, you give me quite an introduction. I'm all nervous now. This is going to be quite a tough act to follow.
Welcome to the Boston Dastard Brigade. How have you been liking the con this year so far?
This is actually my first time at Anime Boston. I have heard it is a legended con. I've been hearing about it for years now, and finally getting to be here is like a dream come true because I really, really love this city. And this con, I mean, I've been to, you know, several at this point in my career, and this so far has got to be one of the best. I mean, it's just tight, it's organized, the kids have been awesome, the fans are great. I'm still waiting for someone to pinch me to wake up. That's how much fun I'm having.
Awesome. Now, what do you like most about Boston?
I love just the it's one of those cities, I've been to a handful of cities that just have the right personality, and like Boston's one of them, Seattle's another. They're just kind of, when I think of a city, that's what I think of, you know. It's got such history to it. You know, I've got this great view out of my window here in the hotel, and I can see the Charles River, and it's just the weather, the lovely, the personality. It's just, I don't know, it's just the kind of that bohemian paradise that I love. It's great. I mean, I can't get enough of this place.
Have you had a chance to look outside during the night and just see just all
yes.
the buildings lit up? It's such a gorgeous
Are
scene.
Are you kidding? I mean, I should be getting work done at night, and I can't because I'm just stuck at my window looking at the river. And everything lit up. Oh, it's great. I really love this town. I would live here if I could. I would.
Buy a second apartment here.
Yeah, totally. And I'll just commute from Texas.
That's not a bad idea.
That's only a 28-hour drive?
Or a 3-hour flight, I think.
Or a 3-hour flight. Yeah, we could do that.
Now, first off, what got you into voice acting?
Well, I kind of fell into it... Well, I don't say accidentally because it wasn't by accident, but it wasn't by design either. I had been an actor when I was younger, but had kind of given up making a career out of it because I just felt it was too chancy, and so I went and kind of chose the safer path. And had a career in something else. And then years on, a friend of mine, Chris Bevins, who I'd known through mutual people, ADR director, writer, and voice actor up at Funimation, just called me out of the blue one day and asked if I'd like to audition off for Samurai 7, specifically for the part of Rikichi. And I didn't know what to say to him except no, because I was terrified of the idea. I'd never been in front of a mic before. I hadn't acted in years, you know, and all my experience was stage. And I thought, you know, what am I? No, I can't do this. I can't do this. It's impossible. And he fortunately does not take no for an answer. So he eventually got me in, like weeks after I begged off. He got me into the booth, and I thought it was just a really long audition process. 4 hours, and we're matching, you know, the animation with the scripts and everything, and finding this voice. I thought, God, how do you people get anything done here? This is how long your auditions are. And at the end of it, he told me, oh yeah, by the way, congratulations, you won the part. We just recorded the first, like, 4 or 5 episodes. So I was kind of tricked into doing this, you know. And then, of course, and Chris... who is just an absolutely wonderful director. All of us up there love working with him because he's so good to his actors and so such a such a genuine craftsman at what he does. I mean, he loves it. You can tell that he kind of molded me into the voice actor I became. And then I just, the rest, you know, I just started getting more work. And then now I'm just like, wow, I still can't believe I'm doing this for a living, but I love every minute of it. So thank you, Chris Evans.
Now, have you found it to be easier to do voice acting as the years have gone on doing it?
Oh yeah, sure. You know, it's easier just because I get less nervous because I know everybody that I work with now and I kind of know their styles. And so I still get very nervous in auditions because that's, you know, I feel that as an actor, that's your job. you should be nervous. Everyone else is. But it is easier. But the more comfortable I get, I like to challenge myself more. And so I like to take on roles that are kind of play against type. Bit to kind of stretch my range a bit, which has been fun. I've been very, very fortunate in every respect in my career. But, you know, getting to do that is very important. And I've had a lot of directors and producers that are willing to kind of give me a chance to play against type, as they often do. So I've gotten to do crazy, crazy, crazy different things. And I love it because of it. And but yeah, it gets easier, but you try to make it harder for yourself as you go, because you don't, as an actor, want to ever get too comfortable.
You really need to, like, push yourself into
the
role.
You really do. Like, I feel that way, of course. You know, I want every role to feel like my first time in some sense, because that's kind of, that's why I like doing it, because you're exploring this new facet of yourself, ultimately. And so you have to take very good care of that and honor it and do what you can. And, of course, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to turn a great anime into a travesty by being a bad voice actor.
Right.
So there's always that pressure.
You don't want to bore kids.
So, you know, you don't want to, it does get easier, but not that much easier as you go along, I suppose.
Definitely. Now, you said you just got a call for an audition just because you had a friend, but mm-hmm. In reality, how hard is it to get into the voice acting industry?
It's pretty hard. I mean, realistically, it's difficult to get into any kind of acting or any kind of entertainment field because it's such a challenging and such a competitive, fiercely competitive market. And, you know, what we do here with dubs is such a specific kind of voice acting that the truth is that the more specific the industry, the more niche the market, the much harder it is to actually get your foot in the door, let alone make a living at it once you've done so. I've just been extremely lucky, and a lot of us that have been able to make a career out of this do, you know, have to wear a lot of hats in order to be able to, you know, pay the rent and to eat as well as do what we love. So, you know, we take on directing and writing as well. But it is hard. It is hard, and there's no surefire method or rules one can follow to get into it. I mean, a lot of it is luck. You know, it helps to be talented, of course. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people that want to get into it that they should study and, you know, if they're not going to school, they should at least go, you know, into a workshop, because acting is a very, you know, personable thing. You need feedback. You need to communicate with people to do it. You really can't hone your craft in isolation when you're acting. But on the same token, you know, people have to know that it does take luck, and if you don't have luck, it's just, you know, you got to have a backup plan. But I've also learned that in this business, as I think in all things, that luck does tend to favor the humble. So as long as people have the right attitude, you know, and don't kind of, you know, kick the door in insisting that they're going to, you know, take the world over with their voice acting skills, then it will be a little easier for them to find work than people who do.
Right. And it's good to be humble in this sort of business.
Oh, yeah. Because
there's great rewards. I mean, look at this. You're surrounded by fans and...
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And the fans, and these fans are like the best in the world, because voice-over artistry in general, whether you're talking like radio or you know, say your movie guy, whatever, is kind of anonymous. I mean, voice actors are known for their voice, but they don't get recognized when they go out places. And that's kind of that's one of the charms of the business. You have relative, you know, anonymity and freedom. But in this business, you know, we have dedicated fans who spot us from a mile away, and he'll come running up to you to give you a hug, and it's just, I love it. It's wonderful. It's the best of both worlds.
Yeah, definitely. Now, when you do voice acting, are there times where you try to get it as close to the original Japanese voice, or do you feel like, for the most part, you got to try to make it your own?
Well, it depends on the director's approach, because as an actor, you know, your first job is your first obligation is to your director, and if you have a good communication with them, then the character becomes both yours and the director's. But we're very conscious of the Japanese, and we always watch it before doing a scene, because I mean this is what we, you know, it's the backbone of what we do. But we're very careful not to try to just do a flat out imitation, because I feel personally that that's kind of an insult to the original performer. Just as, say, the example I like to use, you know, if Kenneth Branagh, when doing his own version of Hamlet, tried to imitate Laurence Olivier, how absurd would that have been? You know, it's like, you know, both the role of Hamlet, in this case, is big enough for both actors. And so it's a credit to that character that any actor can kind of come in and do something different with it. So we try to do something different because it isn't a competition with the Japanese. So it's a fine line. It's a very fine line. We never like to stray or say that we're doing something better. Right. But, you know, because you'd be amazed at the subtle but vast differences there are because of the language difference. Mm-hmm. And you know, it does give you a lot of elbow room to do things that they didn't do in the Japanese, or maybe play out a subtext or something that the Japanese didn't, and that maybe resonates with English-speaking audiences more than it would with the Japanese-speaking audience. It's really cool to notice all that difference, you know, just as I'm sure there's stuff in the original that just could never translate directly into English, and so both end up, I think both the Japanese and the English should be able to stand side by side, and people should be able to watch both and like them both for different reasons.
Right. Because it's not just about the language, but it's about the emotion too.
Absolutely, absolutely. The emotion and the fact that, you know, again, I think it's a testament to how cool anime or a particular show is, and I could cite many examples, that we can go a little, that they're the original creator, the animators, give you that kind of elbow room, really, in the story, that they're giving you characters that you know, even though this was originally in Japanese and we're now dubbing it into English, because just by nature of the show and how beautifully it's done, we actors and directors on this side of you know, the business can still feel like we belong in that show. And it doesn't sound, you know, to me, we don't think of it as dubbing. I mean, especially, I said Bevins' name earlier, but he's the biggest proponent of this, I think, that he feels very strongly that, you know, we're not doing dubs, we're just telling stories. It's like doing a play. Joel McDonald, another director up there who takes that approach, his background is stage. So and it's wonderful as an actor to get that, because we're not just, you know, dubbing. We are acting. We're just taking on a role that other people have played before, as any stage actor does.
Since the 16th century.
Oh, absolutely, and probably long before that.
Yeah.
You know, so that's cool. I mean, I hope that answers your question. That was a very rambling answer, I realize.
No, that's a great answer. I liked it.
I tend to chat, so if you hadn't noticed. Yeah. So
let's talk about Spice and Wolf. Your role as Cret Lawrence, probably your best work. Not only do you show a lot of great emotion and vocal range, but you also managed to, in my opinion, even top the original Japanese voice actor, Jun Fukuyama. Now, what sort of characteristics of the traveling merchant did you take note of when you were researching him? And how did you feel you did with coming across with the character?
I think, well, to answer your last question first, and then I'll get to the first one in a second, but I think that, and I don't often do this because it's very hard to go back and watch my own stuff. I do, because I feel obligated as an actor to kind of, you know, watch my own stuff and learn from it. But I watched Spice and Wolf immediately because I so loved working on that show. It was such an organic acting experience because the scripts written by Jamie Markey, who also played Chloe and who incidentally directed the first four episodes, were so amazing. So, I mean, Holo and Lawrence, you know, who carry really the bulk of that show with their back and forth dialogue, was so crisp and witty, and there's so much undercurrent, you know, there to work with that Brina and I just had a field day. It's a dream to get to work on a show like that with that strong of an adaptation.
It's very Shakespearean almost.
It really is, and that's totally Jamie Markey. I mean, she is a Shakespearean actress to the core. She played Ophelia in the animated the dub of Romeo and Juliet, and that's why, because she's just got this great, and she is. She is just a wordsmith. She's an absolute artist with language. Every bit as talented a writer as she is an actress and a director, which is saying a lot. And so I felt like if I just kind of stayed in the text of what she wrote, that if I just sort of found his core personality, that it just came through. And getting to work off of Rena, and who is one of my favorite voice actresses of all time, also a very dear friend, but she was my favorite voice actress first. Getting to act off these people, I mean, the scripts really brought the best, I think, out in the entire cast. I mean, I certainly owe my performance to those scripts and to Jamie Markey's hand, but as far as, I think my approach to Lawrence was that I'm fascinated by that period of time in European history. When things were beginning to change and just how different life was for people back then, things that we just take for granted now. But I think the thing that really struck me about Lawrence and that really endeared me to him, even before we sat down and started recording it, was, the merchant life was a very lonely one. He's a very sociable guy, of course. He has to be. That's part of the sort of palaver he has to put on when
it's part of the trade.
Absolutely. You've got to be snappy and on your feet and a good conversationalist and be able to make sense in a number of disparate contexts, if you like, in order to sell things, But he's, and it's, for me, playing Lawrence was a chance to get to explore the loneliness that's at the, beneath that veneer that is such a good salesman and such a shrewd business guy. And here this wolf goddess, bursts in on the scene, and he's just like, I think the reason he accepts it at first without going, okay, because I mean, most human beings would run screaming from that situation,
right?
But he kind of just sort of lets it happen to him, and that makes sense because that's who he is. I mean, he's the ultimate adapter, because he's never really at home anywhere. So what's one more odd thing happening? What's a wolf goddess, I'm going that direction anyway. It's kind of that take. And so it was really interesting, but how Polo over time begins to bring out and kind of point out how lonely he is and how kind of lost he is and how in many ways he's still naive about the world, as worldly as he likes to think he is. And it's so much fun to play a character that gets to take that journey, both physically as they head to the north, as you like, and emotionally as he kind of learns what he's missed out on despite, having done so much with his life. Because being a merchant back then, my God, you got to travel everywhere. You got to know, a lot more people in your life than most folks did back then. Most people never traveled beyond their village. So Lawrence knows hundreds of people, but none of them very well. Right. And he's kind of traded, had for, because of his lifestyle, has had to trade, quantity. Or had to trade quality for quantity, rather. And what that says about him as a character is really fascinating, and it was really, really interesting, and even a little heartbreaking to go there, which is why, again, the scripts, oh, God.
It's brilliant.
They really,
well they
really
did
are.
The adaptation.
So, yeah. Jamie Markey is a genius, and she really is. It's a pleasure to work with people like her. They kind of legitimize what we do. There are a number of them, but she is definitely in the top rung.
Yeah, I think it's probably one of my favorite dubs that I've heard in a long time.
That means a lot to me to hear you say that. Thank you.
You're
welcome. Be sure to tell everybody else, because that'll tickle them pink as well.
I'm hoping that the second season will get licensed soon, so we'll be able to hear that.
Yeah. Well, that would be fun, because Lawrence is definitely a character I'd like to get back into the skin of, because he's great. I just love him. I love him. And he and Holo, and just getting to play opposite Brina Palencia. I mean, come on. It's
great anime chemistry from the two characters.
It's wonderful. And it's such an odd subject matter. It's not the kind of show you normally see, which is something else that draws me to it.
Right.
It's really, I'm so pleased that people are liking it as much as they do. You always worry, because the show is kind of an experiment in a way. It does kind of go places.
And it's a successful experiment.
Yeah, that's the best part.
Yes. It's a very outstanding series. Now, another show that I wanted to discuss with you, Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood. You recently took over the role of Scar from Damian Clark.
Oh, God, yes. I am... Whew. That is... I'm a huge fan of the original anime series. And but it wrapped just before my time as an actor, so I didn't really get to be a part of it. I was, however, I think an extra, a couple of extra, you know, bit parts in the film, the conqueror of Shambhala. And so I got to say, that was kind of my giddy, you know, I came home that day going, I got to be in Full Metal Alchemist, oh my God, you know, even if, however remotely, because I was still very new to all this and hadn't done much at the time, was still actually doing it part-time. And here, fast forward, like, what, 5-6 years later, and I am playing Scar. And there is, from the get-go, I mean, Mike is awesome to work with. Mike's been a very, very important, Mike McFarlane, of course, has been a very important figure in my career. A source of inspiration, because I think the original Full Metal Alchemist dub is brilliant, and it's a huge, I'm a huge fan of it, obviously. But, you know, Mike is one of those directors who loves to push me. I mean, he loves to get me to do different things, and to do different things with my voice, and he kind of approached me and said, you know, I want you to, you know, to see, because Damien can't reprise it. You know, he's moved on to other things, can't come back to Texas very often. So, you know, he's given it up. And, you know, which, thank God. I mean, I love Damien's original performance, but I'm glad that he couldn't reprise it, because, you know, I'm sorry for him, because, I mean, I know he loved the role, but, you know, he just couldn't do it for whatever reason. I look forward to meeting him one day to discuss, you know, our takes on the character. But getting to do that voice, it is, there is every, I have to turn off the fanboy inside my head that's going, don't screw this up, don't screw this up, don't screw this up, Tatum, don't screw this up, Tatum. And so, but it's funny, at the end of every take, it seems like I giggle like a girl, because I'm so, like, I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe I'm in Full Metal Alchemist playing friggin' Scar. So I'll say something like, you know, foolish alchemists, and then be like, you know, right afterwards. So I'm delighted that people seem to be liking it. I mean, it's very different, but I will always stand in Damien Clark's shadow as far as I'm concerned with that role, because what he did with the original series was just amazing.
I think you should do a panel next year where it's Scar versus Scar.
Oh, that would be awesome. I'm pretty sure Damien Clark would win.
Now, there's a lot of anime series that come out every year, and I'm curious, is there one particular anime series that has come out 2009 and probably so far this year that you would just like to get your teeth into?
There are actually quite a few of them, but I have a rule. I don't say any of them because I don't want to jinx my chances. So there is one in particular that I won't discuss, because I absolutely want to be involved in it. And if I lose this chance, you know, I don't even know if it'll ever come over here, you know,
but
it's, oh, no hints. And it's one of several, but man, there are several that I've heard about through fans, you know, and through other people. They're like, you should do this. And I'm like, well, tell me about it. And I'll say, I'm like, oh, that sounds really good. I really want to do this, you know. So, but I'll never say it, because I do not. I'm superstitious as hell, and I do not want to. I'm not going to jinx my chances, because the minute I say something, they'll be like, boom, no, it's never coming to America, and you're fired as a voice actor, and everyone hates you now, and just whatever. So, yeah.
Now, in 2007, you reached out towards both writing and directing for anime dubs. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the hardest of the two, and why?
The hardest between writing and directing? Or between, you mean of all of it? I mean, because I think
let's do all of it.
Okay. Well, they all have their own challenges. I find the acting to be the most gratifying, instantly gratifying, because you're right there, and you've got this very, very judgmental audience of two, the engineer and the director, that are just scrutinizing every syllable that comes out of your mouth, every horrible noise, every squish, every saliva bubble. It picks up on that mic, and these people are watching you. So it's very gratifying if you do something right. You know instantly, because, you know, you get this little smile on the other side of the glass. And I have the most fun doing it. The writing is really fun to do. The directing is also very fun, but it's also communal. I mean, what we do is such a concerted effort that there's no one person that's responsible for all of it. And, you know, but, you know, you have this group. I think the writing is probably, in the long run, the writing is maybe the most rewarding. because you get to help other people of your profession bring characters to life. And it's very, very gratifying to have other professionals, peers, come to you and say, oh, I loved your script. Thank you so much. It totally got me there. And to have directors and even engineers say that is really meaningful. But it's the hardest because you do it in total isolation. You know, you do it, and it's often months before your scripts get used because we write, you know, almost sometimes we'll write fully half of the adaptations before we even start laying track down on it. And so you don't know who's going to play what, you don't know who's going to direct it, you don't know anything about the record, how the recording side of it's going to shape up. And so you write a show and you're done by the time you start getting feedback. And so it's kind of hard for me being an actor waiting for that gratification to, you know, delayed as it is, but it is the most rewarding because it's fun. Like I said, when you have your peers come to you and say thank you for that script, that was really awesome, and that's happened to me a few times, and I'm always a flutter when someone like Jamie Markey or you know Chris Ayers, for example, or some other people come to me and say, oh my God, we love this, and I'm like, oh, thank you. It's like getting, what's my phrase? I like to use this phrase all the time. It's like getting drunk dialed by God in the middle of church.
I just want to say I love you, Lord.
You're trying to be good.
I
helped
you, man. You are fucking awesome.
It's like you're in the middle of, you know, you're in the middle of mass or something, and you get this text message. It's like, hey, you want to go like drink? And you're like, I can't. I'm in this. I'm not even sure if that made sense, but hey, well, we'll go with it. It sounds funny.
Now, where can fans hear you next this year in anime?
I'm never quite sure what I can and can't talk about. There's a couple. There's a lot coming out. I don't know what I am free to disclose and what I'm not. I know that Initial D has been announced, very, very proud to be able to work on that show because that is a fan favorite, and that's fun. That is a fun show to work on. That's coming out. I'm not clear on the dates, but I'm involved with that, obviously. And there's a few others, but you'll have to forgive me if I'm reluctant to say it because I'm not good about keeping track of what I can and can't talk about.
So I can't say like my bride is a mermaid or any of those.
Well, you could. I would just have to stand here in silence and.
Awesome. All right, J. Michael Tatum, thank you so much for joining us on the Boston Bastard Brigade. This was probably my favorite interview I've done this year.
Wow, thank you. Thank you, man. I appreciate this. This has been a blast.
All right, thank you so much, and have fun at the rest of Anime Boston.
It's been an honor, man. And same to you.
Here, and I'm sitting right across from the man who is responsible for probably one of the most popular, highly vulgar, and sometimes really fucked up events at Anime Boston, the hentai dubbings, Mr. Dick Tripwire. Thank you for joining us on the Boston Bastard Brigade.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So, first and foremost, how'd you come up with the name of Dick Tripwire?
That's my name, dude. Mama and Dada Tripwire decided to name me Dick, and I've tried to live up to it every step of the way.
Where are the Tripwires originally from? Which country?
The Tripwires, I think the name is some sort of Eastern European, I don't know, I think we came across on the Mayflower as some sort of indentured servant, so I believe that was our slave name. but no, honestly, I'm, you know... The Tripwire clan now is we're New York based, you know, so.
Awesome. Now, where and why did you come up with the hentai dubbings?
Anime conventions have always had dub shows, you know, where fans get up there and do their thing, you know, to whatever their favorite show is, mm-hmm. you know, and I kind of got the idea, well, this would be funny if we did it with the adult material, and the first time I ever did the show, because I had been producing stuff for Anime 18, which was a part of Central Park Media, the first time I ever did the show was at ICON in Long Island, which is a big sci-fi convention that also had anime and stuff like that. And they're still going. ICON's been around for like 30 years.
Wow.
I think it was probably 2001, maybe 2002, the first time I ever did the show. And it was hilarious, you know? We had a good time, and then it just started to catch on, and other places that I would go, you know, would be like, oh, come and do the show, whatever. And it's never been as big as it's been in Boston. We're in the main events room. We had over 1,000 people there last year. And they're nuts, you know? And it is, you know, like you said, it's fucked up, it's vulgar, but it's hilarious. And I think everybody in, you know, gets the spirit of fun that it's all done in. And it's great for me because it's like, yeah, I mean, I'm providing a little bit of the entertainment, but really it's all the fans, you know? They're the ones up there. I just kind of like, here it is, and then let them go. And they take the ball and run with it, so.
Yeah. Are you surprised by how many people show up to this event?
Yeah, sometimes I am. I mean, I'm glad they do because it is a lot of fun. And there's been, you know, I've been doing this at Anime Boston ever since it started in 2003. And there are kids who have been like, I've been waiting 5 years, and I'm finally 18, and I get to come to the show, you know? These kids have just been, like, waiting and waiting because, you know, because that's, they mean business with that. You know, you got to be 18 years old. They will not let you in the door because it's serious stuff, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's fun, but, you know, we got to respect the law of the land. You don't want people to get in trouble. So, you know, I've done it at a bunch of other conventions, and it's always popular, but not like it is here. I'd say the other really biggest one for me is Gen Con in Indianapolis. And I got to tell you, in Boston, they could take a tip from Gen Con. They bring a bar in for the event in Gen Con. Because Gen Con does a lot of role-playing Dungeons & Dragons type stuff.
Yeah.
So they have these, like, taverns at the cons. So they have a liquor license. So because of that, they bring the bar in. And according to, I've had the same bartenders every year the last 3 years. They're like, the bar at the Hentai Dubbing Extravaganza, like, makes more money than any other bar at the whole con.
Oh.
Anybody who does a thing gets a free drink ticket. You know, it's hilarious. So it just makes a good thing even better. Alcohol.
Yeah. Now I'm just having this image of these people totally shit-faced coming, getting up to the microphone.
It's pretty good. It takes the edge off. You know what I'm saying? If people are nervous. So.
It's courage. It's their courage.
Liquid courage. That's right.
Liquid courage. And Hentai Dubbings is definitely, like you said, you have to be 18 to go into the event. It's a rite of passage.
I think so. I'm you know, I'm glad to be included, you know, every year. I mean, it's really fun, you know. And it harkens back to my rock star days, being up on the big stage in front of a lot of people doing my thing, so.
Yeah, and you do your rock star thing, because sometimes, well, I'll go for the event.
I'll play and sing sometimes.
Definitely a little Tenacious D there.
We did some Tenacious D stuff last year, you know, and a couple of years, and we had a little Fat Bottom Girls warming things up, you know. This year I've got some new things planned that are, you know, because this is a 10th anniversary for me, so I have a brief retrospective, sort of a hastily edited thing where it's just some of the funniest lines and weirdest moments from a bunch of shows from over the years. And this year, for the first time, we'll also be featuring a quiz.
Ooh.
A trivia quiz with prizes and punishments if you're wrong. So it should be pretty exciting.
Hopefully we'll have some maids there because in April is officially National Spank Your Maid Month. So hopefully that'll be part of the punishment.
I think I'm gonna have to quote you on that then tomorrow night. Yeah, but well, I have someone who helps me out with the show. Amber, the hentai pirate, who does on Friday night at the convention, she does a panel called What, Why, Hentai, which is a kind of informative thing about hentai and the history behind it. And also just, I mean, she's like Dr. Ruth, like this kind of, you know, like super educated, like sex therapist person, except she's like this big curves Amazon giant woman, you know, because she's very tall, and then she wears these like 6-inch heels, and it's so like it's like the Wonder Woman of hentai comes walking in the room. So she sidekicks for me on some of these, and so she'll be handing out the discipline tomorrow night.
Interesting, and you know what? I'm glad that you have someone like that teaching sex instead of someone that's in their 90s.
Well, her, let me tell you, her panel is really interesting. I mean, and it's just. Mine is all about laughs and fun, but hers actually, you know, you learn a thing or two. It's crazy. But she's got quite an extensive knowledge of all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, 2 years ago was the first time I went to one of the hentai dubbings. And when I first heard about it, my first initial reaction was, okay, there's probably going to be these booths around, private booths, and no one will know who it is that's doing the voicing. No, get them up on the stage.
Yeah, see, 2 years ago was the first time that they put us in the main events because we were too big for any of the other rooms. Because in the years before that, we would just all the other rooms would be beyond capacity. And you know, I've been coming here for years, so I'm friends with the tech staff. So they were like, all wanted me to. They're like, yeah, we'll hook you up in there and whatever. And yeah, I mean, you know, this is a chance for some of these. Look around at the convention. Look at the way the fans dress up. Do they dress that way because they don't want to be noticed? No. You know? So we've got a lot of exhibitions up there. And it's all by volunteer. I'm not pulling people up there.
Right.
Because that's the thing is people want to just come in and hang out and watch and laugh. That's great. But, you know, we pick the people who want to participate. And, you know, they've got no shame. They get up there and do their thing, and they have a fun, good time with it. And,
yeah, especially with, like, last year when we had Chewbacca.
The Chewbacca scene was one of the best ones ever. In the years I've done this, the Chewbacca scene was hilarious. And that was... we'll see what they come up with this year. But that was, like... Because I sent Amber out in the crowd, and I'm like, you know, I want you to find me... Like this kind of guy, whatever. Like she's looking for a specific type, and then I'm like, you know, because the crowd is so huge, I'll usually send her out, and then she'll pick somebody. I'll pick somebody, and like the guy in the Chewbacca suit, I'm like, I can't say no to this, and he was perfect.
You know, do me like you do, Han.
That was so funny. Started, you know, busting out the Star Wars quotes. It was excellent. And the other dude in the scene was spectacular.
And at closing ceremonies, the day after, everybody just knew about it because you saw Chewbacca just stand up and everyone was just cheering him on.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. That one ended up on the YouTube, I think. Which, honestly, the cameras are generally a no-no, so any clips from the hentai dubbing extravaganza that sneak onto YouTube are usually pretty quick and end with somebody being like, hey, dude. Because that is the thing, you know. Some people behind the closed doors, amongst the other freaks, are willing to go up and get freaky, but don't necessarily want their boss to see them do it.
Right.
Which is why, you know, that's a rule that we kind of enforce there. You know, but stuff always slips through. And I'm kind of glad that if something did, it was the Chewbacca thing because it was so funny.
One of your running gags, a making up feature for
Future Tentacle Demon Hellbeast, Part 6, The Final Battle.
Part 3. Or Part 2.
No, Part 2 would be the sequel. This is just regular Part 6. But.
Now, who came up with the Hellbeast idea?
Oh, that was me. And it was something that, you know, to kind of use at conventions, to just a promotional thing. And, you know, because this is when we were getting into doing original production kind of stuff just for fun, and I'm like, listen, you know, and I kind of sold the idea to the management, and we say we could produce this cheap and it'll be funny, and you know, and it was just a fun time. So I came up with this idea, and I sat and like writing the thing. You know, I'd write it like on the bus on the way home, and sitting there like laughing to myself. So I'm like, you know, we'll have the actual college professor, and I'll have a big hot dog, and you know. So yeah, and you know, so and it really came out great. I mean, because it's just bad enough in the right ways. Like the humor is there, but like the camera work is just cheesy enough. You know, it's like not too polished because I think that would actually ruin it. And like, you know,
like the naked voice actor,
Jamal Cavassier Esquire. Jamal is somebody who I worked with a lot over the years, and Jamal he's the man with no shame. That is his mutant power. And you know, it was like, dude, will you, you know, can you be naked? He's like, yeah, you know, he just did it, you know, and he had the hat and the glasses. That was like his addition to the whole thing. And, you know, And yes, we do have the trailer for what was the part two, you know, and then with me and him in that. But
yeah,
you know, because I always threatened to make a sequel, and ultimately, you know, I honestly just didn't have the time, because that takes a lot of work, that stuff, and you know, so I just ended up making these segments that, you know, because there was a story for a sequel,
right?
And what I instead ended up doing is just started taking segments from that and just producing little segments. So right now, I'm working on another segment, which is kind of whatever happened to the tentacled beast. Because, you know, people would ask me, they're like, well, you don't use tentacle scenes. And I'm like, well, yeah, I don't. Because the tentacle stuff is actually kind of passe. Like, you don't really see that as much anymore, and it's the schoolgirls and the nurses and all that.
Yeah. It's more like in the realm of the 80s.
Yeah. You know, and so then people would be like, well, you know, and then I got to thinking, I'm like, well, you know, this would be funny because it's like all the tentacle beasts, like, they're out of work now. So what are they doing, you know?
They're working at H&R Block.
Well, it's stuff like that, like, you know, and like tentacle beasts, like going on a job interview, you know, or like as like a squeegee guy on the street when you're driving, you know. So I'm putting, trying to put something together for that. For, you know, future shows.
I am going to really look forward to that.
It's pretty funny. The thing that I debuted last year with the power of porn, which I was actually nervous about that, because I'm like, are people going to get it? It's a joke, but they did. And that went over really well, so.
The crowds were just rolling on the floor laughing their asses off to
them.
Because, first and foremost, they're there to watch anime porn. I think nothing is sacred to them.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, you just, it's all done in the right spirit of fun, you know? Because to me, the thing about the hentai, because some of it can be kind of brutal and whatnot, but the humor element that's always been there for me is all I would think about is the little Korean dude in his cubicle having to animate 30 frames a second each frame of, like, you know, some anime scene or some freaky thing that's happening that this poor guy is sitting there and his boss is, like, standing over his shoulder going, no, no, more corn, you know? So, like, that's all I can think of. And it just makes me laugh. Anyway.
And then what sucks, too, is over in Japan, they'll have to even censor it anyway.
That's right. You know, it's just an interesting tidbit. There's on one of the La Blue Girl DVDs, La Blue Girl Returns, one of those, we did a commentary track with Toshio Maeda and Rusher Ikeda, who were the director and producer of the La Blue Girl stuff in Japan. And they said, they're like, wow, this is the first time we've ever seen it unmosaic, like uncensored. And I'm like, seriously? I mean, you created this thing. And they're like, yeah, this is the first time we've ever seen it like that. I couldn't believe it, you know? But
I know. You kind of have to feel bad for the animators. I bet you they're like, once they announce, okay, it's time to censor, you can see the Japanese guy crying in the corner. I was like, I know, Toshi, you did a great job with that giant penis, but, you know, government rules are rules.
I know. I mean, you know, the thing is, they're still very detailed, despite the censorship over there. But I think that's, you know, because a lot of that stuff is still produced for the world market, or certainly with America in mind, you know.
Mm. Do you think they'll ever be uncensored over in Japan?
I do. Someday, yeah. you know, I don't know. I just think, yeah, I think they will. I mean, they're a very different culture than here. But, you know, and the picture you get of the Japanese guy is sort of the uptight businessman, you know?
Yeah.
But when you look at their porn, they're way more fucked up than we are. It's all that restraint just sort of explodes out in all sorts of nasty ways. But I do think someday, I don't know when, but, yeah, sure, why not?
Well, I think they've been getting lenient as the years have gone by. I would say maybe 10, 15 years from now, they're going to be, fuck it, it's costing too much money to censor it, let's just do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, I'm sure in Japan, you can just find it on the internet. here, you know? So.
We've had references to, first and foremost, Han Solo and Chewbacca, Necco wafers, yeah, dudes, Bill Cosby, Christopher Walken, and many other things that I personally will never look the same way again because of the dubbings, which I actually do as a report as things I will never look the same way again. What are some of the most shocking things that you've heard come out of the otaku's mouth at the end?
You know, it's hard to say. Boy, the Chewbacca thing was definitely one of the funniest things, but not necessarily shocking. It's, I don't know. I mean, we got Rickrolled once, and I didn't get it because I really didn't even know the Rickrolling thing, and I was like, okay, you know. I remember one guy started talking about, like, calving gloves, like, that you would, if you worked on a farm, you would have these big, long rubber gloves that you would use to when you, you know, had to birth a calf.
Yeah.
Kind of got to reach in there and all this stuff. And I remember that being, like, sort of unexpected. I don't know. It's hard to say because it's a blur to me. There's been so much of this over the years. You know, and everybody has their own style. Sometimes people would parody a certain thing. Like, recently, we did a show, and somebody did, like, Hank Hill. And he did this whole King of the Hill kind of, you know, I'll tell you what, kind of, you know.
Right.
You know, and I got to say, I was like, wow. You know, I've been doing this for almost 10 years, and no one's ever done a Hank Hill thing before, you know? So whenever somebody comes up with something new, that always surprises me. It was like the Chewbacca thing. It was something new. Because I've heard all sorts of crazy crap from these kids, but it's, I don't know, whenever somebody comes up with something new, you know? So, like, last year, definitely the Chewbacca thing has really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. Going to Gen Con, having the... there's a lot of gamers, so I remember, you know, people just started rolling off all these, like, Dungeons and Dragons references, you know, like, rolling for saving throws and all this stuff, and it was just really funny, you know, especially, you gotta appreciate that, they were playing to their crowd, you know what I mean, they were playing to the D&D crowd and knew what to do to make them laugh, yeah, so it's, I don't know, it's every year there's something, so I can't wait to see what it's gonna be tomorrow.
Now, we mentioned, like, the Chewbacca stuff and everything like that, but what other favorite moments stand out for you for the hentai dubbings that weren't as shocking, but just, like...
Okay. This one moment, there was the naked year.
The naked year?
Yeah. And this is one of these things that I'm like, I don't know how this happened, and everything sort of... It's like everything spun out of control. Because, you know, I'm like... I feel like Howard Stern... Sort of, like, things happen on his show that he has no control over whatsoever. But when you put all these people in the room together, weird shit is just gonna happen. So there was one year here in Boston, and I had a sidekick, this girl, Mika Moon, and she's very cute. Very, very cute. And she knew how to work the crowd, and I told her, so you gotta go work the crowd. And the whole thing is, if you wanna get picked to do a scene, you have to get our attention, you know? Because there's hundreds and hundreds of people out there, and I just, you know what I'm saying? It's like, and you gotta stand out somehow. I need to see you. So that year, people took it to a new level. And it started out with, like, you know, girls flashing, you know, pulling their tops up, and I was like, okay, well, I noticed you, alright, you know. And then, like, the dudes started going nuts. When Mika would go out in the crowd to pick somebody and, like, just pants were hitting the floor, and I'm like, okay. And the guy who was the con chair at the time, because the entire staff of the convention who is not busy working at something, they're always there.
Yeah.
Okay, and he's sitting right there, and I'm like, dude, this is like totally out of my hands, because I have no control over what the people do. And that's something I make very clear. I'm like, you know, to the convention, I'm like, I can't, you know, I have no control over what they're going to do, so I'm not really responsible for that. And he's like, I didn't see anything. I'm like, okay. You know, so this one girl gets up, and literally I'm like looking at the crowd, right? And I like look to the left. I remember there were these two girls sort of near the front standing on their chairs going like, woo, you know, arms up in the air. I look left, I look back to the right, and one of them is totally naked. And, like, literally, it was like that. Like, I look at her, I look away, I look back, clothes were gone. I don't know how she did that. I'm amazed. I'm like, you, really? And I just like, I just didn't even know what to say. You know, I was, oh man, you know, it was weird. Apparently she was some sort of, internet person, who did that kind of thing for a living.
Oh.
But I mean, it was like, bang, like that. And that stood out a lot. And then the year after that, they're like, listen, we need to make an announcement that everybody needs to
keep their cool.
Yeah, keep their, and I'm like, that's fine with me. You know, because I, you know, again, because that just was so unexpected and out of the blue. And there were some people who were freaked out by it. I mean, I was freaked out by it a little bit because I'm like, whoa, what the hell? Because at that point, I'd been doing the show for, you know, 4 years at least. And then all of a sudden, and nothing, anything like that. And all of a sudden, it was like, whoa, whoa, you know. So that stands out. That stands out. Chewbacca really stands out. Couple other characters from over the years. There was a dude called the Bondage Fairy who used to always show up, who became a friend. The Bondage Fairy is a buddy, and he was always funny. And there was this guy back in the day, this little, I don't know, kind of like hip-hop kid, and he used to do stand-up, and he used to go by Sex Andre 3000. It was like the name he used. He was so funny. And I would look for him every year. I haven't seen him in like 3 years, but I would every year if he was there, I would always bring him up because he was hilarious. But you know, it's you know,
you get a memory every year that just
pretty much, you know, yeah. So I can't wait to see what's gonna happen this time.
Now, the final question, of course, has to be, what have you got under your sleeve this year for the hentai dubbing?
Well, I told you,
how long should the screamers shield their eyes for?
The quiz is a big new thing this year. And I have my little best of thing. There's a few new scenes from stuff I produced back in the day that I found that are pretty funny. You know, this, some of the dialogue is really funny, and the situations are just crazy. But you know, in terms of the squeamish, you know, it's nothing really that people haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. But it's, again, it's not about that. It's about what the fans are going to bring to it, you know, and that you never know what you're going to get. You never know what to expect. So, but the quiz, I have high hopes for. I think that'll be a lot of fun.
I can imagine that's going to go over very well, and I bet it's going to be a mainstay starting with this convention.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, Dick Tripwire, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks a lot, man.
Boston Brigade. I fucked up on my own name today.
Boston Bastard Brigade.
Thank you so much, Mr. Tripwire.
All right, thanks, man. It's a
go.